in order to more adequately support that insurance fund. And if you were to do this in a careful enough way and consider all of the various funding sources that we need to, I think, go into some detail, you might be able to come up with a Section 27 and 28 that the EPA administrator would buy off on and allow the DEQ to administer the program. In any event, the date of the effective date of this insurance liability fee, we think, should be pressed back to, say, 1990 sometime, January 1st or July 1st, 1990. But I think that the fund that this committee constructs should be very carefully constructed not to put the entire burden, as it is now with the current wording, just on a single class of underground storage tank owners and operators, and to broaden that fee base somewhat.
Scott, I don't understand. Why is it currently on a single class of underground storage tank operators? Isn't it on everybody that owns an underground storage tank?
Yes, I think basically there's many ways to expand the fee base. You could expand the fee base, for example, as had been proposed, on hearings, in hearings on these bills so far, by general funding it, in addition to the fees. That then brings the public into a position of financial responsibility rather than just having it be supported by fees alone, which is what Section 27 and 28 does now.
Right.
That's what I'm talking about, is that it's a single class of operators that are bearing the entire cost for the insurance costs. And I got in the estimate, another thing that troubles us a little bit, that the DEQ is using an estimation of about $2,000 as an annual insurance fund fee cost. So that's pretty darn stiff. It hits our farmers probably a lot harder than it would hit some other classes of storage of oil tank owners and operators. That's the reason why I'm arguing this way. I'm basically concerned that that the little guy gets hit a little bit harder than some others. For example, the military. If you're assessing a fee per facility, the military is going to get out of quite a bit of its responsibility to pay for the insurance cost here by fees. If you were to assess it tank by tank, on the other hand, the military, I think, would more fairly pay its cost. In other words, the fee base would be more broadly distributed. General fund would be another way to more broadly distribute the financial liability in this section. But that's basically what I'm worried about. Another thing I'm worried about is the fact that this committee is being called on to basically act on sweeping, omnibus legislation. And yet I don't think that the research has properly been prepared on your behalf by various of the state agencies. There's a lot of unanswered questions out there, and these bills have to pass, and we're supportive of them, but I don't think the research has been done to really give you the answers you need to draft a good series of bills. That's basically all I have to say. Just to conclude, we request consideration of amendments to broaden the fee base as described, and possibly to add general funds into the insurance fund, so that the EPA administrator will have a good fee base. And we are giving evidence of good faith so that the EPA administrator will approve the program. And then finally, to maybe delay the implementation date into 1990 sometime, so that we can build up an adequate fund and be able to cover the insurance costs, which right now they're just not available to us. We don't have any insurance companies we can go to purchase the stuff. If we could, we probably couldn't afford to purchase it.
That's probably correct.
It's a real issue that, and it hits us bad too, because it runs our farmers out of business if they get sued.
All right. Senator Cohen.
The only problem I have with your comment, Scott, is that the liability exists today in the same extent as the federal government chooses to enforce it, which is where it is. And so if the farmer has a leaky tank, they are now still delaying the effectiveness of the act till 1990. Doesn't help a farmer who has a leaky tank today, because it's there's a real problem, and it's still it's not as if we're going to King's X anybody's liability until 1990, because the liability is there today, and the sooner we get about trying to put some even small pieces in place to assist people, it seems to me. So I guess I don't understand why you think waiting is going to be of a benefit, because you really still have people way hung out with that liability right here today based on the federal statutes and federal requirements? And secondly, my specific question is, what information do you think, if we delayed the effective date and left it up to the federal government, what information would come to light? Would EPA bring to this whole arena that would make us, the state legislature, more enlightened next session or the next session after that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, to answer the first question, yes, our farmers are exposed to suit right now if they pollute a ground or surface water resource, particularly a groundwater resource. And there's no insurance available, so basically if the suit does occur, and the horrendous costs generally involved with these judgments do come down on our operators, our farmers, they're out of business. This is why we've been supportive of the legislation in its broad thrust, and that is to make the insurance available, to make Superfund monies available for cleanup and remedial action and spill and response. But until the EPA fleshes out with rules the requirements for what that liability insurance needs to be, what it needs to look like, what it needs to cover, who's going to be responsible better than it has right now, the state won't know what's incumbent
it's
upon.
It's pretty clearly responsible right now. It's strict liability. We all know what strict liability means.
Senator Cohen, that's correct. I do think, however, there is a debate in the advisory committee. We heard something about it as to whether or not, for example, you know, how far the wording in the, I believe in the CERCLA and in the SARA, the Title III of the CERCLA, how far that responsibility extends. Yes, we know it's strict liability, but against whom? Against the previous owner? Against the current owner? The ownership of the land above the tank which is leaking and has caused the liability might have changed hands several times. So just to say that there's joint and several liability imposed or that everybody who ever had anything to do with it is liable, that's not going to help you really in awarding judgments against the parties that really are responsible. And that's the reason why the RCRA process by rulemaking is going to allow the EPA to come up and flesh out what's going to be required in this insurance liability, in the insurance liability requirement. But it hasn't been done yet. That's all I'm saying. If we anticipate what the EPA is going to do at this stage, we're just going to have to come back in a future session and probably change it unless we anticipate exactly. You've already heard testimony today that the EPA really hasn't been thoroughly consulted as to the implications of this bill and whether or not, in their opinion, it would be certified by the EPA, whether this program would be certified.
I want to ask a question of Mr. Hansen or Mr. Ryder. This insurance fund that's in 115, is it included in this fee?
No.
Okay, so it's not. So would this just be something that everybody would pay into, or would it be something you could voluntarily participate in if you wanted to?
Chairman, again, for the record, Fred Hansen. There are a number of ways that such a fund could be structured. One of them is, of course, to be able to pay in a fee and be able to really provide with a catastrophic insurance, private writing for something less than that. The issue that we're bringing to you is not what that fund is going to look like. In fact, the recommendation from advisory committee was that we should have a consultant do a full study of how that ought to be structured, rather just to have an option there that if, in fact, the Fed said, yes, we've got to have insurance, to have this as a way to be able to try to address some of that insurance possibility for owners-operators within the state.
But just to clarify, what we are talking about is potentially another mandatory fee on underground storage tank owners.
Yes, but understand what the trade-off is at that point.
I understand.
The trade-off is no liability insurance and whatever
right.
The risks are and possibly being out of business.
Basically, it's providing some financial responsibility where there quite possibly would not be any today.
Yes.
And they can't get the insurance today, a lot of them, I assume.
Can't. And EPA now is going through deciding whether or not to be able to exempt as a whole class underground storage tank operators until, in fact, they can get that insurance or whatever else. But assuming that the feds come down and say, yeah, you've got to have it, then you're either going to have people operating in violation of the law without liability insurance, and if caught by EPA, will be closed down, forced to get insurance, or people who want to have that insurance can't find it, and there's no option. This provides at least a possibility of an option, though it's going to cost those people money to be able to participate.
Sure.
It's permissive in that it allows you to move forward on it without requiring you to move forward. May by rule require.
Yes, correct. And again, if we were to do that, it would only be after full involvement of all the people that are going to be, you know, the players out there that are saying, hold it, we want you to create this because it's the only way we can get insurance satisfactory to cover the mandate.
Okay.
That would be our concept.
Thank you very much.
One last thing on both people do say that if you're going to have that, you have to probably have a mandatory participation rather than just having some people opt in and other people opt out.
Right.
Assuming that were done, then there no doubt would be some people who would say, I don't want to pay, and yet would be required.
Right. But you aren't automatically, with the passage of this bill, setting up an insurance system. You are going to investigate the possibility and see whether we can, in fact, provide a service to the underground storage tank owners in the state who are not going to be able to get insurance as it stands today.
Absolutely. I think your word of the service is exactly what it's intended. It was not meant to be mandatory, but to be able to provide an option service.
It could become a mandatory program. Let's be clear. It could become a mandatory program, but only if the service is required.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, just as a comment, right now, the wording in the bill, I know that it's a chimerical. I know that it doesn't exist. I know it's just a mirage, but the wording in the bill states that this insurance fund, which the DEQ estimates to be $2,000 a year, is going to be supported only by fees. That's the thrust of our testimony. We'd like the fee base broadened, and we'd like possibly adding in some other funds there, like, for example, general funds or something else to make it a more fair and equitable distribution of the cost. That's
okay.
My testimony. Thank you.
Sure.
Senator Cohen.
I think maybe I just drop that whole insurance section out altogether, the insurance fund and they can investigate it all they want and talk to the insurance commissioner all they want. Farmers can decide they can go to the insurance company or insurance commissioner to give them the opportunity to consolidate themselves. We can construct themselves in an antitrust so we can allow them to pool together to do that. I mean, maybe we want to, I mean, I'm willing to do that. Just leave it up to the insurance commissioner and the individual as a group to do it. If there's some real concern about what is or isn't in the bill, maybe we just ought to not speak to it and let them see what needs to be done for the next session.
Okay, well, that's certainly a possibility. When we go into work session, we can consider it.
Yeah, why should
they could then, Mr. Chairman, they could go naked for 2 years.
Well, I mean, I think it's going to take 2 years to set up such a thing anyway, in my opinion. I think it would take, if you really started today, it would take you a while to set up such a thing. And it's certainly...
Whatever.
If you want it.
Are there any further questions for Mr. Ashcroft?
4 years.
Thank you very much, Scott. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on Senate Bill 115? Hearing none, we'll close the hearing on 115. I want to open the hearing on House Bill 2472, which is a bill that's come over from the House that relates to the creation of an interstate compact related to the Columbia River Gorge National Scenic Area. And Representative Cease, Senator Cease as well? Okay, Representative Cease.
Put a red bar. I don't know what she's up to. I have no idea. She just came over to chat, I guess.
Well, you're lucky.
She doesn't have anything else to do, I guess.
You're in trouble now.
Yeah.
Representative Cease.
Right. Senator Bradbury, members of the committee, as you indicated, it's House Bill 2472, which passed the House last Thursday. And I kind of get the impression on this bill, the longer we keep it, the more people want to add or detract from it, and the more people want to get into the act. Let me indicate to you at this stage where I gather, and you'll have other testimony, I guess, in reference to this. One, I understand that there's some concern at this point that the provision that's in the bill as we passed it out and was suggested by the governor's people, which would indicate that his appointments would be for pleasure, some sense that that might be in conflict with the federal statute, which provides the appointments are for specific terms.
Oh.
That's something you may want to deal with. I gather another issue has to do with the question of federal government and the fact that it has no power over zoning, and there's some concern about having some statement in the act that would relate to that. I was told by somebody in the hall a few minutes ago, Secretary of State's concerned about the provision in the bill on auditing, and I'm not sure what that is, so you may hear more about that. But as you look at the bill is clearly two things. It, first of all, contains the Interstate Compact itself, which right. is in the Act, and then there are some additional and supplementary provisions that really relate to a compact and the larger question of the program and administration of the program. The only change that the House Committee made within the language of the compact itself was in reference to Article 4 under funding, the third page, on the line 16 under subsection F, the strong feeling of our group. Yes.
Senator Karen.
I lost you on the curve. Okay. Here, Representative Sees, can you
see in Ghost Bill?
I got page 3, line 16.
On line 3, page 3, line 16, sub F. So the accounts of the commission shall be open at any reasonable time for inspection by the public. Earlier there was a line that said that they would be open subject to need to know or something to that effect. We've made it more clearly a provision that the public would have a right to know and have reasonable inspection of the records. That's the only change we made. We made some other changes, but the only change we made in the compact itself. Now the problem there is that, as I understand it, the compact has to be identical.
Yes.
In this state and in Washington, and they're just starting on their perusal of this whole thing. So trying to dovetail these pieces is, of course, one of the mechanical needs of the situation, I gather. But let me indicate to you above and beyond that is that so that's the only change that we made in the compact itself. We did make some substantial changes, most of which were suggested by the governor's office in reference to what begins with section 2 on page 3, section 2 to the rest of the act. And that's substantially longer and somewhat different than the original bill that was printed. The nature of those pieces are of several kinds. One, the original printed bill provided that the governor would make appointments subject to confirmation of the Senate. Basically, that's all it said, but it left the question of, well, the understanding was that people could be removed probably only for cause, though that was not clearly stated in the provision. Because of the governor's request, we had a discussion of it on the committee and agreed with the statement that his appointments would be at his pleasure. As I indicated, that may be an issue.
Mr. Chairman, can I interrupt?
Senator Karen.
Representative Seif, under 99663, it says, my understanding, you're saying that the law itself requires service for a fixed term except for cause. Is that what the Congress did?
Well, the federal statute says, and I think that's embodied, I believe it's embodied in the compact, that there are set terms for these members. There are 12 members, one non-voting member, and 12 appointed members to the tri-state compact under federal act. And other than the initial appointments, they will serve for 4 years apiece. But the issue then arises over the question, can the governor remove somebody at his pleasure if there's a set term? And that's apparently the question. And I don't know at this stage whether the governor's office has a problem with that. But in any case, we accepted that amendment on the House side. And I've been told now that the federal people are raising an issue about that. And that's all I know about it.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, the only thing that, as I understand it, the compact, Article 2, subsection D, the terms of the members and procedure for filling vacancies shall all be as set forth in the federal act.
Right.
9-33-33. And so the federal act
determines it,
and the federal act has language which is...
It has language that simply designates terms.
But does not, is silent on the question of...
As far as I recall, it is.
Do you have a copy of the Federal Act, or does somebody have a copy of the Federal Act?
I have a copy here. We can.
Michael?
We can look at it.
Michael, come forward. Why don't you just come on up?
I hate to do it.
Have you had a chance to review the Federal Act?
Yeah, I think Representative Cease has correctly stated the issue. The federal law provides for, I'm Michael Houston from the Attorney General's office for the record. The federal law provides for terms but is silent with respect to removal. I think that means that there's no conflict for us to provide for removal by state law. But
as long as whoever replaces that person serves the same term as the person that originally had the office. I mean, that's all the terms mean.
Otherwise, it's the qualifications.
Right.
Okay. But anyway, that's an issue you may want to wrestle with.
We just wrestled with it.
Okay. I have no problem with that. Some of the other things we did, and again, these were amendments that were prepared by LC and I think suggested clearly by the governor's office. There is a provision now, and this is Section 5 on page C, making clear that the Gorge Commission may use either Oregon statutes and the Oregon personnel system, or it may use the Washington State personnel system. Making clear it can use either one. But I'm the understanding being that obviously the employees of the Bi-State Commission will be under one personnel system, right?
Or
two.
One or the other, not
both. One or the other. That was added. And then a statement I think that we did have some substantial discussion about and may still be of concern to some people, and that is on Section 6 on the bottom of page 3 and on the next page, making clear that the Bi-State Commission is the interstate planning body. Bi-State Commission is the interstate planning body. Several concerns here. Let me talk about those briefly. There was, I think, a strong sense on the committee, and I believe that's the feeling in the governor's office, though there's some others who disagree with that we will need a third statute. We've got the appropriation bill, which is 5,000 something. This bill, and a sense that we would need a third statute dealing with the land use issue. Though I think that there are several people that are not sure we need a third statute, but they said our committee understood we'd probably do, as does the governor's office. What this particular section does, however, is state that, and essentially I think really relates to the time between the creation of the Bi-State Commission and the time that they develop and have in place the management plan, which will be 3 years or so, that the planning body, the interstate planning body, is the Bi-State Commission. And the reason that we stated that clearly, this was suggested to us by Representative Fallbush and others, that it needed to probably be clear that there would not be two, in effect, interstate planning bodies during that period of time. And I think that makes eminent sense. That does not have, however, as I understand, have anything, however, directly to do with the issue of the impact of the state land use goals and guidelines, that those are still there and can be implemented, can be used by the Bi-State Commission. It certainly would be our hope that as they start to plan, they will use those, and in fact that they will have some impact on what they do on the Washington State side. Keeping in mind, finally, as you go into it, if there's a conflict, presumably the federal law would be what will supersede. Now, also keep in mind, we're talking about three areas. We're talking about the excluded areas, the four on the Oregon side, which are the four cities, the Dalles, Hood River, Mosier, and Cascade Lock, that is, those cities and their urban growth boundaries are excluded, in effect, from the Act. They continue to operate as if nothing happened, for a practical purpose, at least under state
land use goals.
Yes.
All right.
Then you've got the areas that will be under the direct control of the Forest Service, and then you've got the so-called special areas, which will be the ones that we're chiefly concerned about, which will be over the last the final analysis under the control of the Bi-State Commission. And those are the ones really that I think are a big question mark. I think my own feeling is that if you look at all of this, I have a hard time believing with something this big, this complicated, this intergovernmental nature, that there won't be issues down the line that we're going to have to deal with, and land use or something else, that we have no way of knowing at this point what those are going to be. But what this clearly indicates is that the bi-state planning body would be the bi-state commission.
Mr. Chairman, just so that I can understand it, the four cities on the Oregon side with acknowledged plans continue to operate in as before, vis-a-vis those plans. And it is in the special areas where the question comes for need for additional statutory language, those areas outside Forest Service or government ownership, and outside the UGBs where some language relative to LCDC plans, goals, guidelines needs to be further developed. Is that
correct? That's my understanding. Would that be here? Yes.
Okay.
I was very intrigued reading this. When you realize that this is an amendment of current law, current law says that if an interstate land conservation and development planning agency is created by a compact that's entered into by the state, the Land Conservation and Development Commission shall perform the functions of the state with respect to the agreement or the compact. I don't know exactly what that means, but if the functions of the Interstate Planning Agency duplicate any of the functions of the commission, and then it says the commission may negotiate with the interstate agency in defining areas of responsibility and cooperate with the Interstate Planning Agency in the performance of its functions.
Fuzz. Lots of fuzz.
Well, I think that's probably right. In the last analysis, if there's a conflict, I think the federal statute will prevail, but I think what's important here, we do have in place, unlike the situation on the other side of the river, a substantial land use program, which means as that commission comes into play and starts looking at things, it's got something on this side which they could use. Doesn't mean they have to use it all or use it in different ways. They've got something on which to build. And keep in mind also that the members of the commission are appointed by the two governors and by the representatives appointed by the six counties, three on each side. So I think, I don't say we're going to control it, but it seems to me, if you look at the whole program, we can play ball or we cannot play ball. If we don't play ball, we don't do anything. The Forest Service runs it.
Yep.
But if we play ball, we've got some marbles here that we can use that give us some substantial some real opportunities to have an impact on it.
Right.
Both in terms of this side of the river, and I think even more clearly in reference to doing something on the other side where there's practically no land use or zoning at all.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, I think, I look at it on the positive side. I think if you can say, well, I'm worried about it and it doesn't protect all our interests and everything we want, of course it doesn't do that. Except that it gives you some entrees here to make use, I think, of your possibilities.
But as I understand current law, it would require the Land Conservation and Development Commission to be the agency implementing this compact, which is not where we want to be.
Well, I don't see how that, in fact, would work.
I mean, we have a bi-state commission implementing
right.
the compact.
If you've got a bi-state commission, it seems to me you have to, that's created under the statute, but it's the federal statute. I think you have to give it... and I think one of the things we don't need is immediate conflict with that commission.
No, I guess my concern, and I'm sure it's a concern you've had, and I don't know quite how you resolved it, my concern is that who knows what this bi-state commission is going to do. My concern is to make sure that we don't, it's sort of like the Oregon's land use program for Oregon is the bottom line in Oregon. I mean, I don't want to try to force Oregon's approach to land planning onto Washington as much as I might like to try.
Except that when they get through, they have to have a management plan, even though there are three different types of areas on both sides
right.
of the river. They have to have a management plan for the whole thing.
Right.
It's one plan. Now, obviously, there'd be different pieces, but what I think is going to happen, there is a concern, I think, on the part of our people that we will end up, on our side of the river, having less than what our current land use program provides.
Right.
I think what is, if we're handling it well, what will end up being the case is that we can use ours as a base for developing the other side. Although, that's going to take time. They've got as many people on that commission as we have, so there's going to be all kinds of conflicts and all kinds of resolutions and compromises worked out. It's inevitable, but they start at a much lower level than we do, of course, which creates not only the problem, but the possibility.
Right.
One other thing that I think we did in the Act is, again, at the suggestion of the governor's office, is that in the way the bill was first printed, the governor would not have been able to, as I recall it, would not have been able to make appointments until the compact was ratified by both states. The way it is now reads, at the point that we got it, that is, we passed this statute signed by the governor, he may make his appointments. Our county people may make their appointments. They don't have to wait until it's ratified by the Washington state side. Obviously, we don't have a compact until both sides ratify, but the governor could go ahead and make his appointments as soon as we approve the bill.
Senator Cohen.
I assume that the compact will not do its planning functions until and if the Washington side gets around to appointing their members.
Yes.
So we're not going to just have a handful of people.
No. But it would mean that he could proceed the process, get the people appointed and so forth, and get them online. I don't know how long it'll take. But the Washington State legislature is going to adjourn before we adjourn. The other thing, I think we actually have 180 days to get this whole thing in operation. Mm-hmm. At the time, the president signed it in the latter part of November, and there's 180 days from that point to get all this up and running.
Right.